Everybody, welcome to Theology on Tuesday. We're glad that you're here. We're going to go ahead and get started. My name is Justin. Welcome. I think we're in a coffee shop tonight, so this is great.
That's
this is our first time down here, but we're always grateful for the folks at Henry's on the Market to host us. So thank you for coming out. Yeah, you can grab a seat as best you can or stand up in the back. There is pizza, I think, somewhere back there. But as I mentioned, if you're just coming in tonight, the bar out there is the place to grab drinks. So the way this normally goes is we will begin a conversation about a really fun topic. We're kind of continuing what we started last time. But the way the evening works is usually in about 25, 30 minutes, we're going to throw it open to questions. And you'll see these little sheets of paper around the room. If you're not near one of those, find somebody who has it and scan the top QR code, and you can ask us any question related to the topic tonight or not, anything that's on your mind, and we'll do our best to answer it. I believe John's going to be the one. Yeah, there he is. He's in the back. He's going to be looking at all the questions that come in. The ones that you find interesting, go ahead and give those an uptick, like those, and he'll do his best to answer as many or pose as many of those, and we will answer them for us. Just a few housekeeping items before we jump in. The main way that we communicate about this event is through email. It's kind of like pretty old school, I guess, yep. But we usually meet every other Tuesday. Yeah, exactly. So we've got a large email list. You can join that just to know when exactly we meet. It's going to be every 2 weeks from here on out, at least until the summer probably. So join that to stay in the loop here. And then a lot of folks are involved in what's called Holy City Life. And I know we've got two of the ladies up here who run that, Alexandra and Meredith. Y'all can just raise your hands. These two ladies right up front, thank y'all. They coordinate that. Yeah, that's worth a round of applause. All right. So outside of this time, they do some fun things with other folks who are looking for more fellowship opportunities. So I know there's a hockey game that's coming up. There's an art walk that's coming up. You can join the GroupMe that's right there on that QR code to stay up to date and all that fun stuff. So tonight,
but before that,
yeah, go ahead.
I'm Brian.
All right.
This failed to introduce him.
I apologize.
But that's all right. We can talk later. So I just wanted to say there are a number of people that have been asking me about the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe class.
Oh, yeah.
So if you are interested in C.S. Lewis and the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, we are doing a class for 1 hour on Wednesday night, 7:15 to 8:15, at St. Philip's in the Parish Hall upstairs, preceded by free dinner from 6:30 to 7:15, preceded by an informal worship service at 5:30, and delighted to have any of y'all come if you want to come check it out. So,
awesome. Yeah, it's really, really good. Brian is kind of our resident expert on all things C.S. Lewis. So a lot of our times here at Theology on Tuesday, we'll end up talking about Lewis or Tolkien. But he is excellent in that area. So come check it out for sure. Last time we met, we started talking about this book, The Defining Decade. And I think there were only a few number of people who had read it or had heard of it before. But I'm curious. I want to know, did anybody go out and at least look it up or want to get a copy?
And it's free on Spotify.
Whoa.
So you can listen to it if you have the right sort of subscription.
That's pretty cool.
Keep that in mind.
That has nothing to do with the fact that we're covering it, I'm sure.
But I think all their hits like went way up once we started. So
yeah, clearly we have we do have a podcast where we record this and put it online. So you can definitely follow that too and just catch up on old Theology on Tuesdays. But last week, one of the things that she does is say kind of the whole point of the book is that your 20s really matter. It's not that the time before or the time after doesn't matter, but we kind of find ourselves today, a lot of folks in your generation, at this time where you graduate college or you're just starting your 20s and you feel like you have this disposable time where you're not quite a full-on adult, and there's this line she keeps using, 30's the new 20. So you're kind of expected to go out and just kind of, it's not really consequential what you do in your 20s. And what she's doing, she's not a Christian, she's a therapist and a sociologist. She looks at a lot of data and just talks about it from a secular perspective about how your 20s actually are very, very important. Last week, the first kind of heading is your career choices. What you do in your 20s actually makes a difference. It doesn't mean you have to have exactly this clear path, but just doing something was kind of the big idea last week of like, try your best to go out in some direction that you think matters, and do your best in your 20s, and that can actually be really, really important compared to just kind of wasting some time.
Yes.
This week, we didn't really plan this when we started this, but with Friday being Valentine's Day, it kind of works out perfectly. She has this other heading on love and relationships and how you navigate either singleness, dating, how do you get married, should you be thinking about marriage? And she has a lot of really fascinating stuff in here. So there's a lot of ways to kind of tackle it. I'm sure you've dealt with, I mean, we both do premarital counseling, that sort of thing. So there's, as you mentioned last time, a number of things in this book that, even though she's not writing as a Christian, touches on a lot of things that we see in ministry. I was wondering if there's a place that you wanted to start or anything you found interesting. I'm happy to kind of talk about some of the things I found interesting, but I'll just...
Yeah, well, there's several things. And what I would say, part of what, and we said this a little bit last time, but one of the things I love about this book is that even though she's coming from a secular perspective, what she's looking for is what makes for human flourishing. That's what she's looking for. And the conclusions that she's reaching, by and large, are the same conclusions that if you follow what the scriptures teach, you would end up in the same place. And you know, she's not completely on the page on everything, but a lot of it is. And I think the reason for that is that God has hardwired truth into creation and into what it means to be human. And so she's been able to tap into a lot of those things. But one of the things that I thought was really great in, there's so much in this, and we're just skimming on the top of the iceberg in here, so please do read the book. But one of the things she talks about a lot is that the way that so many people in their 20s and 30s look at marriage now is absolutely upside down from the way that it used to be. Mm. And that now most people, and I've had so many conversations in the counseling I do with people who sound just like the folks in her book, and sort of the idea that so many people have today is that I need to get my whole life figured out. I need to be in my dream career. I need to have a house. I need to have the earning potential to pay for private school tuition for my children. And once I have all of those things lined up, then I can begin to think about marriage. And she said it's almost like it's a capstone that once you've figured out everything else in your life. And that is 180 degrees different from the way it's been for most of human history, where the idea was that you would, as you come out of your teen years, begin thinking about who do I want to share my life with? Who do I want to build what that life looks like together? And you're in a partnership trying to reach all of those goals instead of trying to reach them first and then look for someone to marry. And so I think that she's really onto something with that. Part of what makes it difficult, I think, is if you postpone and postpone and postpone and postpone, and you're putting all your energy into checking all those boxes, you're pretty old by the time you get done with all that. Not that life is over by any stretch of the imagination, but you have, by focusing on those choices, you have eliminated a lot of other possibilities. You also have gotten much more set in your ways, which makes it difficult for having a relationship that works.
Yeah. And next time we're going to talk about, in the final section where she talks about kind of how you develop in your 20s, biologically, psychologically, it's pretty substantial. Also, your biology itself and your kind of peak reproductive eras are actually in your 20s. And so that's mind-boggling for a lot of people. Yeah. Last time we talked about how the average marriage age for, I believe, it was in the, like, right around 1960, which was not that long ago.
Right.
For a female...
I was alive then.
Barely.
But I was alive.
20 years old for a female, 22 years old for a male in 1960. It's about a decade later now in life. I thought she did a great job of kind of summarizing. You know, she meets with a lot of folks, but I found this kind of interesting. This is the way one of her clients, she said, I think this taps into the way most people describe dating in their 20s today. And this is one client saying, dating for me in my 20s was like musical chairs. Everybody was running around and having fun. And then I hit 30, and it was like the music stopped and everybody started sitting down. I didn't want to be the only one left without a chair. Sometimes I think I married my husband because he was the closest chair to me at 30. Sometimes I think I should just have waited for somebody who might be a better partner, and maybe I should have, but that seemed risky. What I really wish I had done was thought more about marriage sooner, like when I was in my 20s. I think that's kind of the major thing, and this is one of the things I get a sense of a lot, is people are really like, I can't even think about that. I'm 23, right. Yeah. 24, that is way down the line. And one of the things that I really want folks to hear is like, and she says this a lot, the best time to start working on marriage is before you have one.
Yes.
And that is a really insightful thing to think about, because you are actually preparing yourself in many ways, not just trying to find this magical person out there, but how you prepare for your marriage is critically important before you have one. I thought that was really important.
Yes, and I think one of the things that relates to that, one of the chapters in here is called Dating Down. I'm not gonna ask anyone to raise their hand if they feel like they've ever dated down, but part of what she's trying to get across, I think, in that chapter is that our construct, our framework, when we're thinking about dating and marriage, is so profoundly influenced by our culture in a really unhealthy way. And that what tends to happen is that, and obviously this is a gross generalization, but we are in a culture that is obsessed with physicality and appearance and beauty. And so what drives most people's initial interest in someone is the way the other person looks. And sometimes we get the whole thing completely backwards, and relationships may start in a bar when you see someone who is attractive and you end up having sex with that person, and then you're like, that was sort of bad that I did that, but you're still sort of attracted to the person, so you sort of stay in this limbo kind of thing with that person, but hoping that maybe there will like be some redeeming characteristics that will come along and maybe that relationship will actually work out. And what she says is that we've gotten it exactly backwards, mm-hmm. that we start with that kind of attraction, where what we ought to be doing is looking for people that we have things in common with, people that we like, people that we can build a strong friendship with. Because marriage ultimately is a long and profound and deep friendship. And that is the bedrock of it. And I'm sorry to say, no matter how much Botox you do and how many Pilates classes and everything else, and you can go see Dr. Sunny O and get some work done. But, you know, when you get to be 70, you're not going to look like you did when you were 25. And if that's what the relationship is based on, you're going to be in big trouble.
Yeah. That's one of the sad things that we were talking about this earlier, but you're not supposed to look like there's, and the Bible talks about this a lot. Like
aging is a beautiful thing.
Right. I forget the passage in Proverbs that talks about gray hair being like a crown.
Yeah.
Right. And
yeah.
I think that's nice. I hope I have hair later on, but gray hair. The point is like age is actually something beautiful and worth striving for, gaining wisdom, appreciating the different seasons of life. That was one of the things she said at the beginning, was like, so often in our culture, we've got people in their early teens trying to be in their 20s, what they look like and how they dress and all that. And you got people in their 60s and 70s trying to recapture their 20s.
Yeah.
And so while we think this is a disposable time, everybody somehow wants to be in their 20s at the same time. I thought she had a really fascinating chapter on cohabitation.
Mm-hmm.
And again, not a Christian. There are a lot of things we should talk at the end about the things maybe we would push back on, or as priests would say, she's not in the same field, but I mean, one of them is like, she's just talking purely about human relationships apart from, is there a God? Has God commanded anything?
Yeah.
So we'll come
is
to that.
Is there a design?
Right.
Yeah.
We'll come to that later, but she's talking about one of these things, and I find it so often, a large number of couples, even Christian couples, come and they're cohabitating prior to marriage. And most of them, in my experience, have just kind of ended up there. It wasn't like this conscious decision that, well, it was like, I ended up just spending a lot of time there, and then we were sleeping there, and then I was having too much trouble trying to keep track of where my stuff is. And
it was cheaper.
Then all of a sudden my rent, your lease went up, and so it was like, I'm just going to go ahead and move in. And she calls that sliding, not deciding. And this is why it's so critical. She has a lot of the studies are showing that doesn't actually, it has made probably the adverse effect that many yeah. people think it is. It's like,
yeah, statistically the opposite of what you would expect.
And a lot of people, they saw probably their parents, you know, they got married quickly, they got married young, and so they're thinking we should spend some more time. We should get to know one another. The more we can learn about one another and live together, that can only help, is the way that they're thinking. And she's going, actually, it's puzzled sociologists. They haven't exactly nailed down why, but the stats are showing this isn't the case. And she posits this. She's talking about this couple that started living together. But basically, they were doing... the reasons they started living together and what they were hoping for, it wasn't the same things that typically put stress on a marriage, right? And she talks about these two people who are cohabitating but aren't married. They weren't paying a mortgage together. They weren't trying to get pregnant. They didn't get up in the night with kids. They didn't spend holidays with in-laws when they didn't want to. They didn't save for college or retirement for their children. They didn't see each other's paychecks or credit card bills. Living with someone may have benefits, but in my experience with 20-somethings, approximating marriage isn't one of those benefits. So she's talking about when people cohabitate, it's actually not at all like marriage, because those are the things that really put stress on a marriage when you, and a lot of this has to do with kids, which, again, by and large, that happens within marriage. People are going for that. But I think that was kind of helpful in like trying to understand this may not be a good idea. It's actually probably not. The studies are showing that. But the reason being that these conditions aren't the same as marriage.
Yeah, and part of what is so sad is that, as she said, so many people sort of slide into that. They don't deliberately think about whether this is a great idea or not. And what's in the back of a lot of people's minds is maybe this might lead toward marriage. Maybe this is sort of like a practice round, and we can kind of see if it works well, and then if it does, then we can like go forward. But the problem is it's like practicing the wrong sport. You're not learning the things that you would need to learn in marriage. And actually the divorce rate for people who cohabited before marriage is higher than for people who did not. So,
yeah.
And the other thing that she talks about, and I think this is very real and it's important to say,
yeah.
is that so many people have had difficult experiences growing up because of divorce in their own families or major dysfunction in their families. And because of that, they have a level of paranoia about marriage and some deep-seated and often unvoiced concerns and hurts and things like that around the whole idea of marriage. And if that's a shoe that fits for you, I would really encourage you to talk to Justin or me or a counselor or someone to begin to work through some of those kinds of things, because those types of hurts that are in your background can influence your behavior and getting to a place that's healthy with how to deal with that is really important.
Yeah. Do you remember the part about switching costs or like getting locked in when you're cohabitating? She talked about, I thought that was really helpful. She was basically saying a lot of people, they get together and they think, well, it'll be just as easy to get out like as it was to kind of get in.
Yeah.
Unlike a marriage where you bind yourself, like if I just live with this person, I can easily get out. And she likens it to like signing up for credit cards at zero interest, and then all of a sudden a year comes and you haven't paid it off, and you're like, oh my gosh, getting out of this
right.
is like
39% interest.
Yeah, it's crazy difficult. But she likened, you know, all of a sudden you have like furniture together and dogs and friend circles that you wouldn't necessarily have, and before you know it, the challenge is you've slid into this, and you thought you'd be able to get out if you found out that this isn't a match that's really good. And she's saying by far and away, people find themselves stuck with somebody or in a relationship that they deep down know that they shouldn't do it.
Yeah.
But they're at a point where it's like, oh gosh, 30's coming. I should probably just like, it's too risky. Remember like the musical chairs, it's too risky to get out. I'll just go ahead and get in. And then maybe that often that leads to marriage and then quickly a divorce.
Yeah.
I thought that was an insightful.
Yeah, I thought that was very insightful. And I think, you know, the other thing that she talks about in here that sort of weaves its way through all the chapters in this section is that, again, we have a faulty construct that is really foisted on us by our culture, like, all the time. And the idea is that there is this person out there who is your perfect soulmate, and that you don't want to settle. And you've got to look for that person that their goal in life is to make you happy, and that is all that they want to do. And if it's anything less than that, then that's not the right relationship. Well, that's crazy. It is crazy, and that is not the way things work in the real world. And the way that marriage and healthy relationships work is that you learn to love someone in spite of their flaws, and you realize that you yourself are actually a flawed person who might not always be easy to put up with. And that is why the commitment aspect of marriage that is part and parcel of the Christian vision of marriage is so important. And this idea that when you run into issues, you work through them together, and as you know, in the Christian view, you work through them under the authority of Scripture, and that as you do that, God is using that to sanctify you. And that is wildly different from this idea that you're Barbie and Ken is out there somewhere. But there's so much of that in our culture, even if we don't want to admit that out loud, it infects our thinking and causes us to mess up the way that we approach the whole dating situation.
Yeah, totally. I think that there's a thing that she talks about, this movement, as you alluded to earlier, that starts with physical and then it moves to kind of like, is the person decent, kind of a good character,
yeah,
to then the really important stuff too late begins to come out, and even then it's not really talked about. She talks about this movement from lust to love to like.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of a helpful framework. But
because it's upside down.
And it's upside down.
Yeah.
Or at least the way that I took some of this, she's talking about, like, it's really important that you are alike in the things that matter, the
yes,
things that actually matter the most. And then that you genuinely like the other person in kind of the very practical ways of life. So I found, you know, she mentioned this couple, and they used to just, like, in their 20s were, like, they just had fun. They just loved having fun. He was in music, and she had this career, but they liked to party. And they moved in together. They were decent. But then, like, they were getting frustrated over, like, how the other did the dishes, how they did the laundry, who was going to cook, how much they drank during the week, who went out with friends on the weekend, that sort of thing. And the last chapter of this I found really helpful in this section on love. It was 29 conversations that she encouraged people to have about those things that matter. And I think, I don't know, I'm curious, in your counseling with couples and premarital or marriage counseling, like, the nitty-gritty liking one another, like, how important is that? Do you have to agree on every little detail, or does it matter if you disagree how to do some of those things? But what in general, I find people just don't talk about any of that,
yeah,
when they should.
Yeah, I think it is so important that you do talk about those things. And I think you've got to be on the same page about major things. But one of the things that I think is so difficult is people don't know how to have real conversations about these things. And they feel so risky, because if you feel like this might be the one, and if I have this conversation, I might drive this person away, it's very threatening to have these conversations. But the conversations are really, really important. And this is, again, bringing in the Christian side that's not really in the book, where you need to believe and trust in the sovereignty of God. And if you are trusting in the sovereignty of God, there's nothing to be afraid of about being honest in these conversations. But I think being able to talk about real things is really important. And one of the things I talk about with people a lot when we are doing marriage preparation is that we live in a culture where, if you think, let's just say this book represents the problem, and let's just say Alexandra and I are in a relationship And this is this problem that is between us. And what our culture says is, as we look at this problem, either Alexandra is going to figure out how to win over me with this problem, or I'm going to figure out how to win over her. And that we're driven that way, that somebody's got to win my way or the highway. But actually what marriage calls you to do is to put the problem over here to, thank you,
to I'll be the problem.
Understand that the two of you, that Alexandra and I are on the same team. We are on the same team, and this is a problem that is confronting our team, and that the two of us have got to figure out a way to get to the other side of this problem together. And that is a radically different construct than the way most people approach conflict in relationships. But that is the biblical way of doing it, and it changes everything when you look at it that way.
Yeah. And a lot of times I hear from folks, either in dating or engagement, normally not at that point, but especially in dating, where I just don't know if I can have, that seems too heavy, too intense to go there. She had a really, in saying, like, if these conversations, if having this kind of conversation sounds like a lot of work or something that your partner would not be interested in doing, then I would take that as evidence that perhaps you and this person are not ready to further entangle your lives at this time. I think that's a really helpful way of phrasing it. No matter where you are, she again reiterates that it's never too early to begin talking about some of these things. Who you are, what you like, where you see yourself going, and the other person. And I think that's just so often I see folks who never really start asking those questions mm-hmm. or talking about those substantive things. And it's not that you're going to agree on everything. The key is, can you agree to disagree on the things? Like, this doesn't really matter to me.
Yep.
Or the problem is when all of a sudden you disagree about disagreeing to a point in too many things, and then you feel kind of stuck in it,
yep.
But you don't want to leave that. And I think all of these factors come together, and that's what a lot of folks in their late 20s who are just kind of found themselves living together, feeling like they should get married. They've never really talked about this, and it's like, warning. Like,
yeah.
That's what I took from this chapter.
Yeah. No, I think that's exactly right. And one of the other areas where that shows up is when you are in a relationship that Scripture would say is unequally yoked, where you've got one person who's deeply committed to growing in their Christian faith, and the other person is just not there at all. And that is a recipe for trouble.
Real quickly, just anything that you wanted to say, obviously she's not a Christian, anything you would want to say in this chapter to folks if they're reading it for the first time and they're like, well, I went to Theology on Tap and they recommended read this book. And wow, it talks about all sorts of things that I was surprised the priest recommended. Anything that you would want to say about that?
I would say we would not embrace the part about gay marriage. We would not embrace that. But I do think that most of what she says, I would absolutely agree with. But I think that the part is not, the part that I would have trouble with is not so much what she says for the most part, but some of the things that she leaves out.
Yeah.
So I think being under the sovereignty of God, really in your 20s, working on growing in your relationship with Jesus, that is the most important thing that you can do. And the more that you do that, I'm a huge believer that Proverbs 3, 5, and 6 is one of the most important verses in the Bible. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your path straight. And I think if you are deeply invested in trying to love and serve Jesus, that a lot of these other things are going to fall into place.
Yeah.
And she doesn't say
right,
that.
Right, right. And yes. There are a couple points where, you know, she's like, the science is showing that, like, cohabitating is not really a good thing to do before you get married. And she's like, but I'm not here to tell you if that's what you should do or shouldn't do. And
but we're here to say,
I'd be like,
you
no, you shouldn't
do
that.
That.
And
yeah.
Mainly because it goes against, like, she has no dimension with God in this book. It's all about just
it's all
what do we see among human beings. And I'd be like, well, the reason that doesn't work is actually God has made the way in such a way, made the world in such a way that this is meant to be, you're supposed to, in marriage where you've bound yourselves in every way, that's when you're supposed to start sharing all of your life, financially, physically, and all that. And she's like, it really doesn't matter if you have sex or not. What's important is why. And I'd be like, no. You should have sex only in marriage. There's actually a part, though, I found, I mean, obviously, we do believe marriage in the scriptures are about one man and one woman. But she had a part that I thought was really interesting, that heterosexual couples can learn. I think this is a true and right point. In homosexual relationships, they have to do a lot of conversation about just gender roles and how you are going to do these mundane tasks because they don't have gender stereotypes to work off of.
That's true.
And yeah. So I think that's a true, this is where science kind of taps into something that's kind of obvious, but that's something that in general is true. You should be talking about, like, how are these things going to work in your relationship? But just don't swallow everything she says as, again, she's not writing from a Christian perspective, yep. Which doesn't mean you can't learn some really great things.
But there's lots of good stuff.
There's a lot of good stuff in there, but we don't endorse all of it, I guess. Yep. So, if there's anything else, I think it's about time to throw it open.
Well, the one other thing I would say that she alludes to sort of in passing a couple of times is that one of the other things that's happened in our culture that we need to push back against is that we have come to a point where it's much easier and much more acceptable to be physically intimate with someone than it is to be emotionally intimate. Mm-hmm. And that it is, you might be in a place where you are sexually involved with someone, but you're afraid to have real conversations. And that is like totally upside down.
Yeah, and that's not how it's gonna work. And that is probably gonna have, it's already starting to have devastating consequences on a society. Because people need to get married, they need to have children, and you're going to have a hard time doing that when you reverse the order that God intended. So, I don't know where John, there he is, yeah. How are we doing on questions?
We're doing good. If you want to take the time, go ahead and upvote some of the questions that you might want to, reemphasize, or if you want to go ahead and submit other questions, please feel free to go ahead and do so. I'll go ahead and ask the first question. One of the first directives God gave us was to be fruitful and multiply. As Christians, how should we approach family planning, contraceptives?
That is a great question. And it is one of those things that there, for whatever reason, has not been much attention paid to, particularly in the Protestant wing of the church. And there's been this disconnect culturally between the whole idea of sex and procreation. And that is a linkage that I think it is imperative for Christians to re-embrace, that is part of what it means to be male and female. It is part of God's plan and God's design. And I think that the whole idea of procreation is really important, that children are a positive good. And that is something that is sort of a shocking statement in our culture today. There are plenty of influencers out there that will tell you, we're so glad to not have children because we get to just do whatever we want to, and our poor friends are having to pay all this money and they don't get to sleep anymore at night because they have these stupid little babies and we don't have to worry about that. That whole view, in case you didn't pick up from that, is maybe a little bit selfish, maybe, just a little. So I think that the whole idea of that linkage to procreation is important. There are a variety of viewpoints that I think can be defended from the scriptures about what that actually means within marriage. If there is no contraception at all, if there's some contraception, sort of how you deal with all that once you're in the situation. But I think that the understanding of the linkage is really, really important.
Yeah. I like that you started with framing it. I mean, the very question itself, similarly, in light of the command that God gives to be fruitful and multiply, and the value of life and starting there. And I think we have to recognize we live in a day that is so individualistic that you shouldn't, we're told, I think, consciously and subconsciously, that you shouldn't you should just be true to yourself. Don't conform yourself to anybody or anything. But like, love demands you conform to somebody right. else. And like, specifically, parent to child means giving up your rights and sacrificing yourself for somebody else, which really goes against the grain of what our culture mm-hmm. is producing at this point. We don't produce self-sacrificers. And I love what she says in here. In the context of all these 29 questions, she talks about, you know, there are two real eras in any relationship. It's not really before marriage and after marriage so much as it's before kids and after kids. She says those who are married without kids are actually far similar to those who are not married without kids than actually those who do have children. That's the major difference. And she says in a lot of these questions, you'll notice a lot of them have to do with kids. And she says the reason is that for many couples, their children will be their greatest source of joy and meaning, and they will also be their greatest source of conflict
yep.
and stress.
Yep.
And I think I was like, amen, spot on. I think that's so helpful. And when it comes to what time it is in our world, we have to recognize I don't think the Bible says you should never have, it's always wrong to have, even say natural family planning, to try to be wise about, is this a good time to have a child? Maybe you shouldn't have sex. Maybe you should try to be wise in how you do that. But we live in a day that is generally don't have children. Mm-hmm. And so I think the error is not, like, I think given that context, we should encourage folks to try to have more children, but to be wise in that. And I think one of the things that we should say is because life is valuable and life begins at conception, we have an obligation to try to preserve life from the very moment of conception. And so any sort of abortificant in contraception, so killing an embryo or anything like that, is actually taking a life. And now we need to consider the life of the mother and those things. Like, sometimes it gets complicated, but protecting that innocent life is really important, and furthering life is also yes. important, not just living for yourself. So yeah. that's a lot in a short amount of time, hopefully. But yeah, that's as good as we're going to do there.
Can you give advice for preparing for marriage while in a season of being single?
Yes. That's a great question. There are so many things. So I think one of the things to do, going back to what I said a minute ago, is the more that you invest in your relationship with Jesus and trying to become more like Christ, to be invested in the scriptures, to be deeply invested in fellowship and in your local church, all of those are things that God will use to shape you and to sanctify you that will be part of the journey that you are on. I also think one of the best things you can do when you're single, even if you're not dating anyone at all, is get Tim and Kathy Keller's book, The Meaning of Marriage. That is an excellent book, because part of our problem, I think, for so many of us, including myself, even after I've been married for decades, is that our cultural ideas about marriage are always getting tied up with us. And one of the things that the Keller book does robustly is to cast a Christian vision of what marriage is. And so the more that you understand that when you're not married, when you're not even dating, it gives you a construct to think about what's important and what's important in the person that I might one day start dating and maybe get married to. And so I think having that framework is part of the best preparation that you can do. The other thing that I think it's good to do is to hang out with some old people who've been married for a long time and just talk to them about their marriage and
what makes
it work. Watch them, all those kinds of things.
That's so good. Yeah. I totally agree. I think preparing while you're single to read, what does the Bible say about marriage? Start doing that, because one of the key things in dating is trying to figure out, what does this other person view marriage?
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't know what you understand marriage, mainly from the biblical perspective, it's not really going to be all that helpful. You need to know what you are. I would say a couple other things, too. What makes a good marriage are two people who are both deeply aware of their own sin and are willing to die to themselves and serve another.
Yeah.
So you can do that single. You should do it. And you mentioned community and friends. I think having being around others is really important, but serving, trying to go out of your comfort zone and actually die to yourself and serve others in practical ways is one of the most important things that you could do. Another real practical thing, this is a deeply introverted person who likes my own space, is I would caution you against living alone in singleness. Find other people of your same gender and have roommates, because when you live by yourself, it's very easy to think you're actually pretty decent of a person. When you have roommates and the way they live in a home is quite different, it can be really frustrating, right? I mean, I'm sure most of y'all know what this is like. That's really critical for marriage, because you're not going to be identical to your spouse in every way. But navigating some of these, like she talks about, who's taking out the trash? How do you load the dishwasher? Where do the dirty clothes go? You shouldn't do this, right? Like, all, like, these are, it's funny, but like, those are the very practical things that if you just live by yourself, you think, this is how everybody should do it. And that's not the case.
Yeah.
And your
does
marriage
not work that
will keep
way.
That in, yeah. in your face. So that would be one thing I think is important.
What if you're in your 20s and you're nowhere near marriage the way you, what if you're in your 20s, you're nowhere near marriage the way you thought you would be? People tell you to be, to put yourself out there, but you feel like you have.
Yeah.
Oh, that is such a good question. And one of the things that I think is so unhelpful is for well-meaning friends to say, put yourself out there. Well, what does that mean?
Yeah, that's a good.
Does that mean create a Tinder profile? You know, that is just not helpful. But I do think that when you're in that season, that the person asking that question, I bet there are a lot of people here that are in that season. I would actually go back to something that she talked about in the chapter on work, and one of the things I can't remember her exact phrase. Is it loose connections?
Weak ties.
Most of the time, I think it's very easy to get into the mindset of, okay, I'm a Christian, I'm praying that God is gonna send me my perfect mate. And you may like pray vigorously for that, and then nothing happens, and you get discouraged. And so part of the deal there is, I think that you, and I'm not gonna say you need to put yourself out there. What you need to do is to be proactive in what I would consider to be a godly way. The most likely way that you are going to meet somebody with whom you are compatible is through other people who you know and love and who know and love you. And that could be through your parents' friends. It could be through people that you've met. It could be if you are in a wedding and there are a bunch of groomsmen and bridesmaids that you haven't met but who are dear to the people who are getting married. Those are all contexts where the power of weak ties can be significant. And there's nothing wrong with talking to older Christians who are in your life and saying, you know, I am... really in the season of discerning about dating and marriage and all of that. And, you know, are there ways that you would suggest of trying to meet some people, or, you know, if you know people like me that are situated, would you want to like do a dinner party or something like that? There's nothing wrong with being proactive in those kinds of ways. We are proactive about looking for jobs, but we're not willing to take the risk to be proactive in that way. But I also think being involved in fellowship, being involved in groups like this is a great way to meet different kinds of people. And one of the interesting things, and I can't remember if she cites this or if I was reading it somewhere else, but one of the things that's interesting is that the divorce rate in arranged marriages, even in cultures that are free, not, I'm not talking about oppressive cultures, the divorce rate in arranged marriages is much lower than in freely chosen marriages. And there's something in that about this idea of people who know and love you and want what's best for you being sort of involved in that process.
And surprisingly so, the happiness rates are not, it's not, they're not like all miserable in
marriages too.
I think that's important. A couple things that stand out in this question, I think I'm so glad this was asked because this is so critical. One of the things that I found from a Christian standpoint that this book doesn't give is your identity.
Yes.
And who God says you are. Like, she brings up this, she calls it the self-perceived mate value. I don't know if you remember that,
but
idea of like how you think yourself, what's your value?
Am I a 10?
In the way people, am I a 10? Yeah. Am I a 2? Like, and sometimes, but the point is a couple things. Your identity as a Christian is given to you by God. And that's a critical thing that I think informs all of this. Because there's another word that she doesn't use that I think is critical as well, which is contentment.
Yes.
In your season of singleness, contentment doesn't mean being passive. It doesn't mean that you don't long for something. It means that you are able in this season of longing to still appreciate what God is doing in your life and to be present and active in the here and now, and to go to Him with your prayers. And I think that active dimension of contentment, like to actually, you know, I think for many people, putting yourself out there, I think is important to define, but like, are you willing to have some of the, it takes courage to have some of the conversations that are vulnerable about, that they're actually meaningful. And that may, for many people, just be like, no, but you actually might find some people are really drawn to the fact that if you're willing to talk about substantial things that actually connect with where you want to go in life and your vision and that sort of thing, asking those questions, even in that sense, is risky, but it can be deeply worth it in this season. But I think contentment is one of those key things, and where you long to be married. I think we also need to say that there are no, like, there's not like a status that's higher than the other, singleness and marriage.
Right.
I think we are in a day that prides singleness probably to a fault of you should, it's obviously one of those commands at the very beginning to be fruitful, multiply. So marriage, having children, a positive good. We live in a day that seems to downplay that. But also singleness from the Christian perspective was pretty radical, where these people were actually not seen as less than.
Well, Jesus was single.
It was a totally full, like, human divinity in human life was single. So
yeah. The one other practical thing I would say is I think it is great to do stuff with groups of friends, that guys and girls together, where people are not paired off, because it takes so much of the pressure off and it makes it a lot easier to actually get to know what people are like.
Yeah. A couple more.
What is a current trend you're seeing in your experience in premarital counseling?
That is an excellent question. There are a lot of things that I see. One of the things that I think is an unfortunate trend that I seem to be seeing more and more of with people that I'm working with is this idea that they, is kind of what I was talking about early on tonight, that they want to get everything fixed and arranged before they get married. And so sometimes you'll find people that, like, they'll come to me and say, we're thinking we're going to get married in about 6 years. And I'm like, okay. But invariably, it comes around to that they want to pay off their student loan debt. I mean, it's not like the things are bad that they want to do, but the construct is upside down. So I would say that's a trend. Another trend that is, I think, partially because people are getting married later, is that more and more I find people who are what I would call sort of stuck in their ways, and just sort of the nitty-gritty of the way you live your life, how you wash the dishes, how you do this thing or that thing, and they think, my way is the right way. And then they get in this relationship and the other person thinks their way is the right way. And you wouldn't think that that would be like such a big issue about who takes out the garbage or what way you fold a towel or things like that. But that kind of stuff, if you hold on tight to it, can cause a huge amount of conflict. And that all goes back to what Justin was saying earlier about we've lost this idea about what it means to die to yourself. Mm-hmm. I will never forget when I was waiting to get married and standing there with my dad, who's my best man, before we went out. He said, I just want to remind you that marriage is not 50-50. It's 100%. You have to give everything. You can't hold on to your own rights. The only way marriage can work is to be willing to sacrifice yourself, which was very good advice.
Yeah. Was the question what discouraging trends or just trends in general?
Trends in general.
Okay, great. Yeah, I think... Well,
there might be some encouraging ones.
I'm deeply encouraged in some ways. And other, I mean, the cohabitation one I talked about, like it is shocking both in and out of the church how often, and it, again, it's like this was not a really deeply thought out, it was they slid into it.
Yeah.
And I
yeah.
think she talks about just how devastating that can be. And couple that with, you know, the statistics about how it doesn't really have a good outcome in marriages and divorce and all that when you cohabitate beforehand. So that's one of the discouraging trends. But actually, I'm really encouraged when folks truly take God at His word and are going to try and like do what you just said, 100%. We are going to have God first in each of our lives. We are going to pursue Him individually. And then after that, together and not being consumed by one another. When they actually fully submit to the Lord in every area, not holding anything back, I'm deeply encouraged by some of these
beautiful.
People, and it had all of a sudden the marriage becomes a light to others around them, and it's not this relationship that's consumed with itself. And I'm like, oh, these things are really durable. These relationships. And I'm seeing more of that.
I would agree with that. Yeah, me too.
Sorry. What would you say to a Christian couple who wants to cohabitate during engagement since they know they're getting married?
I would say, let's think through this very carefully. And I would encourage them strongly to not do that. I think that it is, often when I have people that say that, the main reason is finances. And I would really encourage people, if somebody came to me with that situation, to say, let's sit down and see if we can think through creatively about how to solve the financial problem without cohabiting. Because I think that the whole cohabitation steals part of the wonder and the joy out of getting married. And so I think it is not desirable to do that.
I think Keller in his book frames it really well when he's basically like, when you're trying to cohabitate but you're actually not married, and married being that legal component that you've legally bound yourself in every way, when you're trying to reap the benefits of a relationship that doesn't have that all-encompassing bond, publicly, socially, financially, legally, and then physically. Usually they just want to jump to the physical and let's play house together without those other key things. That relationship actually doesn't have the security to where you can truly be yourself. You will still be putting your best foot forward, whether you're going to admit it or not. Somewhere deep down, you're still hoping. And they talk about cohabitating couples. Well, I guess that's not engaged, but I would still say the same thing's true. When you're engaged, there have been times, I'm curious, in your premarital counseling, folks who are engaged that then your advice, I'm not willing to marry you right now. And if you are living together, all of a sudden it's infinitely harder to actually, you need to be able to say, until you have the ring on each other's finger and the vows shared, to be able to get out if you need to. Because once you're in it, you need to be in it. And I think that's critically important. There's one other thing I forgot, but I think that's good enough.
Do cohabited couples divorce more because cohabitation causes divorce, or because divorcees are the kinds of people who tend to cohabitate?
She brings that up.
Cause or correlation?
Yeah, she brings that up, and she actually says it's really, she talks about it's the how and the why as opposed to the fact that they do correlate.
Yep.
But it's
yep.
not just simply that people who are likely to get divorced are the same people who are likely to cohabitate. She says it's actually conservatives and progressives who cohabitate. So she brings that out. It's not necessarily those kind of really progressive people who are going to just be out for themselves in the long run. It's folks across the board.
Yeah, it's across the board.
I think that's,
Is it okay for Christian couples to not want or not feel called to having children?
That's a great question.
That is a great question. I think that the answer to that probably is it depends. I think that there might occasionally be a reason not to do that if there was a specific calling that God had on your life that you were absolutely confident about, that it would be very difficult to do that with children, like if you have to be involved in some sort of mission thing in a place where there couldn't be children. But I would say that would be the very rare exception. I think that if you are a Christian couple, you can't put God in a box on that issue, and that you know, the scriptures are pretty clear about children are a blessing. You know, you may be in a situation where you can't have children biologically. That's a different situation, but I would say only in the very, very rare exception would that be a decision that you should make.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. I would want to ask why, right? What's behind, what's the rationale for that? And if it is, you know, I don't know, sometimes you'll hear like, well, the world is so bad, why would you want to bring any people in? I'd be like, I don't know. Yeah. And if it's selfish in any way, you'd be like, no. The whole point of, in many ways, marriage, and I would say parenting too, is it challenges you. It's a crucible of forming you into the person God wants you to be, right? Like you find in those moments where you're having to die to yourself so much that those are integral in forming you into who God wants you to be.
Yes.
And so it's not that, again, single people can't have that, but these are, by and large, how civilization has continued, and most people will want to be married or have children. So, and I think that by design, it is a good thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Thoughts on approaching dating apps with a Christian perspective?
Oh, yeah. This is a good one to end on.
I have heard so many horror stories from dating apps with people, but I've also done marriage prep with people who found each other on a dating app and where the Lord has been right in the middle of that relationship. So I think it's very hard to say absolutely yes or absolutely no. It's probably not a big surprise to you that I'm not out on any dating apps. So I can't really give you a firsthand report on the pros and cons of different ones. But I do think that it's always better to have in-person sorts of introductions with people that you know and trust. But I also think I've seen God bring people together through dating apps. So,
I can't confess to know what all, I assume, and you can correct me, there's like a wide variety of different dating apps. She calls them introduction apps. I think that's probably right.
Yeah.
But that does, that, I mean, she takes a more lax approach on it than I do, because there's a phrase in ministry, what you win people with, you win them to.
Yeah.
And I think there's something to that when it comes to dating. Like, how you are, quote, putting yourself out there to meet other people isn't neutral necessarily. Like, you're likely to find the kind of, I mean, you could always find, like, the perfect, amazing Christian in a bar. Like, of course, you know, it could be, but like if you are on Tinder trying to find a good life partner, that maybe it could happen, but like chances are,
seems unlikely.
Putting yourself, and I'm sure there's other apps that have algorithms that try to put you with people that are, I'm looking for this. So I don't want to be just very rigid and say you shouldn't always, but by and large, like showing up in person, trying to find other interests that you have that maybe you can find relationships and be introduced to other people as opposed to online, you're just always going to put some version of yourself out there that's disembodied, that isn't like it's just
curated.
Better to try, I would say. It's not that it's wrong, it could happen, but I think it's better to try some other ways going to church, going to various interest things that you have, hobbies, that sort of thing, and doing it in person.
Yes.
Is probably my advice. Yep. So. Well, guys, this is fun. We've got one...
one more.
At least one. We'll see how it goes.
Yes.
But join us again in 2 weeks. We'll be back here at Henry's. I'm not sure. We'll let you know.
We'll be somewhere at Henry's.
We'll be in this space, if not in the
Whiskey Room. Don't give up hope if you can't find us.
Yeah. But thanks for coming out.
Thanks for coming, y'all.
See you in 2 weeks.